Now to the question of the future of jobs in Australia and what sort of jobs we're going to have. We've spoken to people in the past about the coming automation of jobs one might not expect to be automated. For example, that of junior lawyers, of radiographers, physicians. Gone are the days when people can say that it's the menial tasks that will be automated. Now we're talking about many, many different tasks at what one might describe it at a higher level being automated. But does that mean jobs will go? Some jobs might, but others might come. Joining me now to discuss what it means, the coming automation of jobs in Australia, is Professor of Economics at the University of Melbourne, Jeff Borland. Jeff, welcome to Counterpoint.
Hi, Amanda.
Well, the coming automation of jobs, is everything going to be automated and we're all going to be lying on lilos on our back lawn sucking banana milkshakes?
Well, historical experience suggests that's definitely not going to be the case. In Australia, for example, if you go back to the mid-1960s, which is about as far back as we can go, and look at the total amount of work being done in the economy and adjust for the size of the population, that hasn't really changed since the mid-1960s. So we've already had a relatively long period with increasing use of computer-based technologies from the early to mid-1980s, and so far it hasn't affected, relative to population size, the amount of work that's being done in Australia really at all.
No, so the type of work being done might change, but the volume of work doesn't go down.
That's right. So the type of work, the type of occupations people are working in, the industry composition of employment, that's changing all the time. That's not something that's just associated with new computer-based technologies. That's really a feature of history going back to the Industrial Revolution, that any technological change leads to the destruction of some jobs and is associated with the creation of new types of jobs. So certainly we should expect the composition of employment to change, but thus far there doesn't seem to be any sign that there's a decrease in the total amount of work. And there's a couple of reasons why it's probably sensible to expect that there wouldn't be a reduction in the total amount of work.
And what are they?
There's two sort of main reasons. First of all, when you have new technologies, those mean that you increase the amount of output that labour can produce. You increase labour productivity. That increases our real incomes, our purchasing power. And so what we've found so far since the Industrial Revolution is that people find new stuff that they want to spend that extra real income on, that it might be taking less hours of work with new technologies to produce the goods and services they used to consume, but they find new things that they want to consume, which takes up the labour that's been displaced by the technologies, takes that up and uses it to produce the new goods and services. The second reason is that technologies destroy some types of jobs, but they also create new jobs and increase demand for other types of labour. I guess a simple example would obviously be with computer-based technologies. Software programmers, a job which didn't exist before computer-based technologies, but now is a major area of employment. Sort of amusing example I heard on the radio the other day was that in the United States, there's now over 20,000 people employed as drone pilots. And associated with that is the point that, you know, we adapt to the new technology. So I guess something that you played an important part in since the late 80s in Australia, we've had a big expansion in higher education. We've gone from, in the early 80s, about 5% of Australians with a bachelor degree or above to sort of getting up towards 25 to 30%. And so the fact that we've got a more highly educated population and workforce means that, you know, they're able to work with the new technologies, they're able to do the new jobs which are being created by those technologies.
Mm. Do you know, I'm constantly fascinated by what people will spend their money on. You made the point that, you know, we earn more money, we get more productive, and we find new things we want to spend our money on. And when someone says to me, that idea won't fly, I always say, well, don't forget, there was a market at one point in Australia, you might remember this, Jeff, for pet rocks. Do you remember that?
Yep.
People will buy a pet rock. So I can't see, therefore, that automation is going to end the life of the retail sector, because someone will think of something that we want to buy other than a pet rock. and we'll go and buy it, and someone will have to make it and paint it and, you know, put a name on it and all those other sort of stupid things people do.
Well, yeah, several times it's been predicted that we were getting to satiation point in terms of what it is we wanted to consume. Economists as famous as John Maynard Keynes in the 1930s thought that because of new technologies making human labour so much more productive that you'd be able to produce everything that people wanted, you know, with very little labour, and people would have, you know, therefore a huge amount of leisure time because they'd hardly be working at all. But I guess as humans, we seem to be driven to consume by, for example, you know, relative comparisons that...
Not keeping up with the Joneses, you mean?
Well, exactly. That type of phenomenon.
I'm sorry, Jeff, to interrupt you, but why do you economists speak in such fancy language? You know, you talk about purchases with relativities in mind. Why not just say straight out, well, we want to keep up with the Joneses?
Well, yeah, so keeping up with the Joneses, okay. If you want to put it that way. Yeah. Phenomena like that seem to explain why we haven't yet got to the point where we feel sort of comfortable with the amount that we're consuming.
Jeff, just looking, for example, at the question of lawyers taking that, there's apparently a number of programs law firms can buy now that will do the basic research on particular issues and cases, and it's pretty good. And you might say, and you'd be probably right, that the jobs of junior lawyers in that sense will go. Now, that's okay if you can use some software to search all the databases and get the research you need. But what it means is that junior lawyers don't get that experience. How do you fill those gaps where work that might be menial, that can be automated, is done by junior people, but the process of doing that work is a learning process for them? When that's discarded and everyone can just suddenly use the automated search engines, how do junior lawyers get to be senior lawyers?
I'd assume that, you know, if you think of other similar situations, what will happen is that if law firms realise that on the one hand, it's cost effective to be using technologies to do those tasks, but on the other hand, this is an essential skill for junior lawyers to have, then they'll introduce training programs that more efficiently give the junior lawyers those skills. It doesn't seem an insurmountable problem to think that on the one hand, you can, you know, reduce your costs significantly by having technology do this task, but if there's something about that task where there was learning by doing for the lawyers, then you create another way for that to happen. A point that people might also make about that example of lawyers is, oh, well, you've got the technologies doing those jobs, therefore there's less demand for lawyers. But of course, that's ignoring the price effect, that if that's reducing the cost of legal services, then that will lead to some increase in the quantity demanded of legal services. So even though the sort of labour share of what's being done by a legal firm might be smaller, the total amount of business that legal services are doing might be bigger because the cost is coming down.
Can I ask you one final question? There was a CEDA survey, Australia's Future Workforce, and there's been other surveys put out, commentary put out about the doom and gloom from this. You have to be careful, don't you, when you read these surveys and not necessarily believe everything you read?
Well, I think you have to look at the fine print. But one of the things we do is look at some work done by two Oxford technologists, Frey and Osborne, who've probably, it's the most well-known study forecasting how many jobs are going to be lost due to computer-based technologies in the next 10 to 15 years. They've predicted that in the US there's about 45% of jobs could be lost in the next 10 to 15 years. And so we just look at what assumptions underlie that prediction. The way they get to that number is, first of all, they went to a technology conference and asked some technologists which out of a list of 70 occupations they thought would be automatable. They then roll out those forecasts across all the sort of occupations in the US. They assume that every job in every occupation, which they say can be automated, is going to be automated. And they don't worry at all about whether it would actually be sort of cost effective for firms to implement those new technologies. There's some Herculean assumptions underlying that 45% prediction. The OECD redid their analysis, just changing one of the assumptions they make. They said, well, look, we don't think it's sensible that every job in every one of those occupations is going to disappear. Let's try and make a more realistic forecast of how many jobs in each occupation will be lost in the next 15 years. The number they got was 9%. As I said, it's really important to read the fine print on some of these predictions because they're often based on rather extreme assumptions.
Yeah, that's quite right. Jeff Borland, Professor of Economics at Melbourne University, thanks very much for joining us and talking about the future jobs in Australia.
Thanks, Amanda.
Professor Jeff Borland, Professor of Economics at the University of Melbourne.